next case on our oral argument calendar is case number A18-456, State versus Victor Lynch. Thank you to counsel for being present and timely on a day with bad weather. Ms. Godas, you may approach and begin. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your name, but
that's okay, Your Honor. It happens all the time. It's actually pronounced Goddess.
Goddess, thank you.
So, good morning, Your Honors and counsel. May it please the court, my name is Jessica Mers Goddess, and I represent the appellant in this case, Victor Lynch. The state charged Mr. Lynch with aiding and abetting the murder of Trina Marstad. The state identified his accomplice as Stephanie Monitor. The state gave Ms. Monitor immunity for her testimony at trial against Mr. Lynch, and the state agreed to jury instructions and verdict forms that use the accomplice liability language. On appeal, when faced with the challenge to the sufficiency of the uncorroborated accomplice testimony, rather than argue that there was corroboration, the state argues now that Ms. Monitor was not an accomplice. The state is wrong, and because she is, and because that issue is central to two of the issues that are still in dispute on this appeal, I'd like to focus my argument there. Ms. Monitor was an accomplice as a matter of law in this case. The standard is a person is an accomplice if they could have been indicted and convicted for the crime that was charged. That standard is met if there is evidence that that person played some knowing role in the commission of the crime and took no steps to thwart its completion. Now, importantly, active participation in the overt act that constitutes the offense is not required, and the knowing role can be inferred from the person's presence, companionship, and conduct before and after the crime. The evidence in this case clearly establishes that Ms. Monitor was met that standard and was an accomplice. She participated in the planning of this crime with Mr. Lynch. She knew exactly what Mr. Lynch intended to do before he did it. She willingly participated in every step of the commission of this crime. She never once made any effort to dissuade Mr. Lynch from commission of this crime. And she actively assisted after the fact with attempts to cover up this crime. She denied to police and paramedics that Ms. Marstad had used any drugs, and she is the one who concealed and attempted to destroy evidence of the drug use after first responders and police arrived.
Isn't there case law that says that after the fact, concealment is not considered, it's not factored into the determination whether someone's an accomplice?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There's two things going on here. There have been cases where when the alleged accomplice is only involved in the crime after the fact, when that's all you have evidence of is the after the fact, then the after the fact is not sufficient to establish accomplice liability. But the case law also clearly says that after the fact conduct can be taken into account as part of the whole context of before, during, and after. And whereas here we have conduct before, during, and after commission of the crime, the after the fact conduct is certainly relevant to the whole analysis.
Did you say earlier that Monitor helped plan the crime?
I did say that. And what I'm referring to by that, Your Honor, is remember that the crime in this case is essentially the providing or the administering of the lethal dose of drugs that killed Ms. Marstad. So when I say she was participating in planning the crime, I'm talking about the crime generally here as the administration or the providing of the drugs that killed her. All three of these people who were involved in this case.
How did she help plan the crime?
So all three of the people that were involved in this case were part of the discussion about doing speedballs. Speedball is the combination here of the methamphetamine and the heroin. So she, Ms. Monitor, came with Ms. Marstad to Mr. Lynch's apartment, and a discussion ensued.
For a different purpose, I think, right? I mean, when the two women went, my understanding is they were not going to do drugs, but to have a conversation.
I guess it is fair to say that all we know from the record is that they wanted to go to Mr. Lynch's apartment to talk to him for some reason. What exactly that reason was, I don't think is clear from the record. But what is clear from the record is once they get there is when the discussion begins about preparing and ingesting the speedballs.
Wasn't there testimony about the fact that they did some drugs, Ms. Monitor and...
Ms. Marstad.
Ms. Marstad, before they got there? And is that relevant, or what happened the next day, during the day? Is that relevant to our decision about whether Ms. Monitor was an accomplice?
I think they are both relevant, and certainly what happened after the fact is very, very relevant to this court's analysis. You are correct that there is evidence from Ms. Monitor herself that before they went to Mr. Lynch's apartment, Ms. Monitor and Ms. Marstad were elsewhere engaging in drug use together. Then they went to Mr. Lynch's apartment. The three of them engaged in drug use together there, and then they stayed there throughout the course of the night until the next morning. That's when Mr. Lynch left the apartment and was gone, or the motel room, actually, and was gone for the day, where the two women remained there together until he eventually came home that evening.
One additional question on the accomplice issue. I was looking at the State versus Barrios Quintana, not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly,
yeah.
Which and then at the State's brief, the State tries to distinguish that case, saying that Ms. Monitor did not acknowledge any role in the commission of the shooting. Could you just address that for me, please?
Well,
I'm not sure that there was that much difference in their role, but I'd like your perspective.
I really don't think there is a difference, and I would actually point you to the Barrientos Quintana case to say that I think here our circumstances and facts are very much like what happened in that case, where the Supreme Court did in fact decide that in that case, I can't remember the person's name, but that he was an accomplice.
Hernandez, I think.
That sounds right. You would think I would know because that was my case, too, but it's been a long time. Anyway, in that case, it was the same to the extent that what we have is the alleged accomplice in both of these cases willingly acknowledging and admitting that they were present before, during, and after. And critically important, too, is that these people knew what was going to happen before it happened and made the conscious choice to stay and engage in the act that ultimately constitutes the crime charged in this case. So that's another important fact in this case and what distinguishes it from some other cases where accomplice liability has not been found. Those tend to be cases where there's no evidence that the alleged accomplice knew what was going to happen before it happened or knew what the person who did the overt act intended to do. That's not what we have here.
I had a question about that, I guess. Given the, third-degree murder, I think the elements are that the person, without intending to cause death, does proximately cause a death by administering or otherwise. I mean, if she had not died of an overdose, there would be no crime whatsoever, right?
That's correct.
I mean, it's Mr. Lynch. Nobody, I think, accuses him of intending to cause death, obviously, but. So how does that, I mean, that's different, I think, from Mr. Hernandez, you know? I mean, he knew that what was going to occur would be a crime. But I think in this case, Ms. Monitor would not, I mean, I guess it's a crime to do drugs, but not the crime for which Ms. Marstad died.
I understand your distinction that you're making, Your Honor, but I don't think that's critical to a decision one way or the other in this case about whether she was or was not an accomplice. I think what's important here to understand about her knowledge, taking us back to what the standard is for finding a person is an accomplice, it's that he or she played some knowing role in commission of the crime. So that's really what the key is in terms of what this person's knowledge here is. What is the knowing role that they play? And to the extent that Ms. Monitor knew what was going to happen, knew that the speedballs were going to be prepared and administered. That's the knowing role that she played in the overt act then that ultimately resulted, unfortunately, in Ms. Marstad's death. So it's not that she had to know ahead of time for sure that death was going to happen. It was that she had to play a knowing role in the act that ultimately then did result in her death. So
it seems like that... I mean, in general, the two women, I mean, the one man, Mr. Lynch, was the actor, and the two women were similarly the recipients or the objects of his actions. That, you know, she was, she, meaning Ms. Monitor, was more situated like Ms. Marstad than like Mr. Lynch.
Well, one thing that I'd ask you to keep in mind about that, Your Honor, is that what we have here, what we know about this case, and comes from Ms. Monitor's self-serving testimony. Let's remember here that our context is that three people go into this room and only two come out. This is a classic situation of accomplice testimony and an accomplice case where we've got two people left, the only two people who know what happened in the room, and one person points the finger at the other and says, he is entirely responsible, I am entirely absolved of any responsibility. That's why our statute 634.04 requires that when the state has a case like this, corroboration is required. The statute requires that a conviction can only stand if Ms. Monitor's testimony is adequately corroborated by other evidence that tends to restore confidence in the truth of her testimony and to point to the defendant's guilt in some substantial degree.
And but in determining whether a person is an accomplice, it seems to me we can only look at, well, at least all the evidence in the record. I know you're looking at the pleadings and the verdict forms and so on as well, which is something to talk about. But I mean, in every case of we're often going to have self-serving testimony. But we have to take the evidence in the record because that's all we got, right?
That's true. But in cases like this where all we have is self-serving testimony, you have to look at this record for adequate corroboration. And before I go on to that, if I could take one step back to the point that you raised in the context of your question with some other things that we can look at here. While I do, my principal argument is certainly that the evidence that's introduced at trial establishes whether a person is or is not an accomplice, I do think it's important that we not lose sight of the fact that this was a case where accomplice liability was charged by the state, and the state identified Ms. Monitor as an accomplice for purposes of prosecuting Mr. Lynch of this crime. The state gave Ms. Monitor immunity for her testimony, which also tends to indicate and support the standard of she could have been charged for the crime. The state agreed to instructions and verdict forms that contained this accomplice liability language. And the verdicts have very, very specific language in them, which we don't often see in verdict forms, that really pin down and identify this accomplice liability as the basis for the verdict. So I think those color this case and provide an important context that we not lose sight of the fact that below, the state did not dispute that she was an accomplice. It is only now on appeal that the state has flipped its position and rather than argued, yes, she's an accomplice and here's our adequate corroboration that we can point you to, the state does the opposite and says, nope, she wasn't an accomplice after all. And I think that's troubling and deserves some further exploration of why that is.
I briefly reviewed the transcript of the closing argument. It seems like, as far as I recall, the prosecutor really never mentioned anything done by Ms. Monitor to facilitate the crime. First of all, am I correct in that? And secondly, isn't that relevant to the question whether she's an accomplice?
My recollection of the closing argument, and I believe I've cited the pages for you in the context of my brief, I'm sorry I don't have them here in front of me, but is that the state did certainly rely on and point to specific elements of Ms. Monitor's testimony to establish Mr. Lynch's guilt in this case. While I would agree with you that I don't think spent any time in their argument pointing to establishing corroboration, I don't think that's what their focus was on. They were certainly pointing to elements of her testimony and relying on her testimony to establish his guilt in this case.
Maybe what I should say is the prosecutor did not refer to evidence about her role in, you know, a knowing role in the offense that she contributed to the crime.
Well, I think I don't know if I would agree with that characterization of it, Your Honor, because certainly what the prosecutor is arguing and what the state pointed to in the trial in this case was an acknowledgement that Ms. Monitor was there participating, knowing what was happening, and a willing and active participant in it, as in terms of her pointing to her credibility as a witness, to say you can rely on her testimony that Mr. Lynch did it because she was there doing it too. She was participating, and the state certainly didn't shy away from that. They didn't try and make any suggestion that she somehow didn't know drugs were going to be ingested or that she somehow didn't partake. I mean, they certainly acknowledged, and she admitted in her own testimony, that she was in lockstep with everything that was happening in this case with Mr. Lynch, that she participated, that she saw what happened, and she pointed the finger at Mr. Lynch as only Mr. Lynch being responsible for Ms. Marstad's death. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Raggetts.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. I'm going to follow appellant's lead and focus on the accomplice issue this morning, but I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions you might have on the Spriegel issue or the prosecutorial error issue. SM was not an accomplice here. The case law couldn't be more clear. Knowledge and passive acquiescence are not enough, and that's all we have here. And indeed, appellant conceded that below. Appellant said below, quote, there was no evidence that SM had done anything other than be there. Well, just being there does not make you an accomplice. The case law, again, could not be more clear on that. And there are recent cases that have really bore down on the idea of what you have to be an accomplice. And I think the McCook, if I'm pronouncing the right, case from 2007, which is mentioned on page 28 of appellant's brief, is very important. Because there the Supreme Court said for an alleged person to be an accomplice, they must have, quote, intended his presence or actions to further the commission of that crime, unquote. So the state has to prove intention to facilitate or further the crime. Knowledge, passive acquiescence aren't enough. And appellants talked about SM's role or her planning or her conduct. All that was just being there. She didn't plan to have appellant inject TM with a needle. She didn't take any role in that. There was no conduct of hers that facilitated appellant injecting the victim here, TM, with a needle. There was no planning that went into that. SM knew they were going there, and arguably she knew they were going there to get drugs, but buying drugs from a drug dealer or getting a drug dealer doesn't make you an accomplice of the drug dealer.
Why did the state grant her immunity, and doesn't that imply that she had some potential criminal liability?
Well, she admitted to essentially aiding after the fact. She lied to the police. She admitted using drugs and arguably possessing drugs. So she was putting herself in legal jeopardy by testifying here. And the case law, again, is quite clear that aiding after the fact doesn't make you an accomplice. And there's no case law I'm aware of that says if the state grants immunity, that's somehow a concession that the person is an accomplice.
Well, it's relevant, though, right?
It may be relevant, but I think if you look at what she admitted to doing here, you can certainly see why she could have taken the Fifth Amendment if she hadn't been given immunity, because she admitted lying to the police after the fact, helping to cover up the crime, being there, using drugs before being there.
Is the immunity agreement in the record, and does it have specific terms or bases like you're describing?
I'm not sure that it is in the record, Your Honor. That hasn't been an argument that appellants made, that the immunity has particular terms that prove she's an accomplice. And ultimately, that's the question before the court.
I think appellant has referred to the grant of immunity as being a factor.
But appellant hasn't specified any terms in the immunity that would suggest the state knew she was an accomplice or agreed she was an accomplice, as opposed to just giving her immunity so she'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but, and not worry about admitting that she used drugs, that she lied to the cops, etc. And again, I think it's important here that appellant conceded below, essentially, that SM was not an accomplice, and the state never agreed that she was. I think it's important to focus on what happened here. The defense here made a last-minute motion for an alternative perpetrator defense, which the judge granted on the day of trial. So the prosecutor's operating on the fly here. And if appellant had testified and said, I didn't do it, SM did it, well, then the accomplice liability language would have been appropriate and necessary. It turned out that appellant didn't do that. He didn't testify at all, perhaps because of the impeachment he faced. And it would have been better if the prosecutor had on the fly decided to take out that accomplice liability language. But that's asking a lot in the middle of a trial. The prosecutor never said in closing argument, yes, I agree she's an accomplice. He essentially made a fallback argument that even if you don't think appellant did it, if he assisted SM doing it, he's still guilty under this language. But there's no evidence in the record here that supports accomplice an accomplice action, that there was anything here other than knowledge and passive acquiescence. Appellants referred to SM's self-serving testimony, but as this court has pointed out, that's all we have. Appellant could have testified here. He could have pointed the finger at SM, but he didn't. And of course, on review, you have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. And SM never said that she played any role in this crime, unlike some of the other cases we've discussed. She was just there. Yes, it would have been better morally if she'd stopped it from happening, but she had no legal responsibility to do that. That doesn't make her an accomplice that she didn't tell TM, no, don't do this speedball, you can't handle it. She saw appellant inject SM with the needle. She didn't stop him. She didn't assist him in any way. Appellants never even alleged that she assisted him in any way.
So, Mr. Rayards, thinking about those other cases, let's talk about the State versus Barrios Quintana. Because when I read that case, I thought, well, isn't, you know, someone who's a passenger in the car, a car where another passenger does the drive-by shooting and is a passenger and knows there's going to be a shooting going into it, and it doesn't leave it, but it's just the passenger. Isn't that really what the role Ms. Monitor played here?
Well, I'm not sure that that result can hold up after the McCook case that says the state has to prove that you intended your presence to aid. If you were there, like if you just caught a ride with somebody and they did a drive-by shooting and you didn't intend to aid them, you're not guilty. If you intended your presence to aid because you were looking out for the cops, you were identifying the victim, if you played any active role, then you're guilty. But there's no evidence here that SM played any active role. And we have to focus on what I'm talking about here, the active role in administering the drugs. She may have played an active role in going to the apartment and even perhaps arguably in getting the drugs from appellant, but she didn't somehow assist in him delivering the drugs to the two women. Going to a drug dealer, again, doesn't make you an accomplice of the drug dealer. And she certainly did not assist in any way under the only record you have in front of you of appellant injecting TM with the needle. She said, he tried to get me to let him inject the needle too. I said no, but SM said yes, and unfortunately ended up dead. And again, there's no indication here that anyone intended to commit a crime. So I could think that is where this is different from a drive-by too, where there's an intentional crime and at least an attempted murder, if not a successful murder. Here, no one was trying to kill anyone. Unfortunately, SM agreed to appellant's offer to assist with the needle, and SM simply played no role in that.
In your responsive brief, you argue only that SM is not an accomplice. Do you concede that there's no corroboration, if corroboration were necessary?
Right. I'm not making a harmless error argument because there, as appellants pointed out, there were only two people there. Appellant, only two people who are still alive who were there. Appellant and SM. The only way we know what happened there is from SM's testimony.
Didn't mean to refer to a harmless error doctrine, but I mean, if she is an accomplice, then corroboration is required, and if corroboration is present in the record, then the evidence is sufficient. But
right.
you're not arguing that. So are you conceding that there
that.
Is?
I guess the harmless error would go more to the failure to give an accomplice liability instruction,
right.
Which also didn't happen here. But yes, I concede there is no corroboration here. There couldn't be. There's nobody else there. So it all comes down to whether she was an accomplice because she was there and knew what was going to happen. Although, arguably, I'm not even sure she knew it was going to happen until it happened. She said he offered to shoot me up. I said no. SM said yes. There's no indication she had advanced knowledge of appellant's plan to try and talk them into letting him administer the drugs, or that had advanced knowledge of SM wanting appellant to administer the drugs. But even if she knew the latter, again, passive acquiescence does not make you an accomplice.
With respect to the instruction, isn't there case law that says that if it's unclear, if a person might reasonably believe that the other person's an accomplice, then the instruction should be given?
Yes, there is case law like that, and my argument is twofold here. First of all, appellant never asked for such an instruction.
Right, but under the plain error test,
Right. So you'd have to say Judge Smith plainly erred by not sua sponte giving it.
Isn't that part baked into the case law here? I mean, I think the case law does say, even if it's, my understanding, even if the instruction is not requested, a district court should give it if the circumstances warrant.
Right, and so ultimately it comes down to, again, whether there are facts here that would support an instruction, which I don't think you need to reach, because if there are such facts, I've conceded there's no corroboration. So whether or not there was an instruction, there's insufficient evidence if there's no corroboration. But here, appellant never asked for it, and again, there are no facts that would support it. If appellant had testified and said, yep, SM helped me do it or did it, and it was a disputed factual matter for the jury to decide, that'd be one thing. But under the only facts in front of the jury, SM played no knowing role. There's no evidence she, again, intended to further the commission of the crime, as is required under McCook and the more recent Milton case. So there are no facts here that could support giving such an instruction to the jury to decide whether she was an accomplice, because there's no evidence at all, period, that she was an accomplice. That would just be speculation, and I'm sure the case law does not require the instruction just if there's some hypothetical way the jury could guess that she was an accomplice when there's no evidence to support it. So, again, here, the defense never argued below that she was an accomplice, never asked for the instruction, never argued in closing argument that she was an accomplice. Yes, the prosecutor made a fallback argument, but under these circumstances, that was understandable. The prosecutor never conceded she was an accomplice. That wouldn't be relevant anyway to the only question before you, a pure legal question of whether the facts establish that she is an accomplice, such that she had to be corroborated. And I think I've hit the point here where I'm beating a dead horse. So unless you have additional questions on that or the other issues, I'll simply ask that you affirm.
I found the law that I was thinking, case law, it's the State versus Lee Supreme Court opinion from 2004, where, quote, an accomplice instruction must be given in any criminal case in which any witness against the defendant might reasonably be considered an accomplice to the crime. And then further, if the evidence is disputed or susceptible to different interpretations, then the question whether the witness is an accomplice is one of fact for the jury.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't disagree that that is something that should be done. I mean, usually the defense requests it if there's any chance that someone could be an accomplice. But even if they don't, perhaps a trial judge has a duty to do it sua sponte, but only if the evidence supports it. Otherwise, you'd give an accomplice instruction in every case where there was more than one person at the scene of the crime. There has to be evidence to support it. There isn't any evidence to support it here. None, because appellant didn't testify. And indeed, appellant admitted he helped with this. He claims he just helped with the tourniquet. He says he didn't actually put the needle in. But he admitted he helped with the administering the drugs. I think that's enough. Well, it's certainly enough for the manslaughter. And on the third-degree murder, there's just no evidence that would support him not delivering the drugs or him not administering the drugs, which are the two different bases for the two different third-degree murder convictions. So unless you have questions on the Spriegel or the prosecutorial error, I'll simply ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Raggetts. Ms. Gaddis, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. So, 2 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is, I'm troubled again by the suggestion here by the state that the state never agreed that she was an accomplice. Again, let's not lose sight of the fact that it was the state that moved to amend the complaint to a charge accomplice liability. This started with the state. I find it troubling, I guess I can say, that the state would suggest that they would make that motion to amend the complaint and bring forth a prosecution premised on accomplice liability if they thought that there was no evidence to support that. We all know that prosecutors are ministers of justice, and I don't think they regularly bring forth prosecutions that they don't have evidence to support.
But that, and I understand that that amendment was made on the day of trial in response to the defendant's notice of an alternative perpetrator defense, right?
I don't remember if it exactly was the day of trial. I think the motion to amend might have become sooner than that. I will agree that it was close to the start of the trial, and I will agree that the record shows that it's the state did that in response to a noticed alternative perpetrator defense. But I don't think that changes my analysis, which is that the state still chose to go forward on that theory of accomplice liability, and I think did so in good faith.
I guess, I mean, it seems like that they tried to plead a basis for accomplice liability for him if he presented a theory of, if he presented a defense case based on the theory that Ms. Monitor was the one who did it. But he didn't present such evidence, and so it seems like that possible scenario just didn't materialize.
I agree with that characterization of what the record is in this case, but I don't think that really answers the issue before you, which is our law is clear that whatever the parties may have intended, whatever theories of the case the parties might have started with, our bottom line here is what matters for purposes of sustaining the conviction here and on appeal is if, as the case comes in, the evidence actually shows that a witness who has testified is or could be considered by the jury to be an accomplice, then that's where our statute kicks in that says that that has to be corroborated. No matter whose theory of the case was what to begin with or how it developed, what matters is what the evidence is in the final analysis. And that's why ultimately the district court even has the responsibility to appropriately and adequately instruct the jury on accomplice liability if there's evidence to support it. And again, we know that a court is required to give instructions when the evidence would support it. Here, the court did give accomplice liability instructions, and we presume that the court's not giving instructions when it's not supported by the evidence. It was supported by the evidence. She was an accomplice. That's why the instructions were given to the jury. That's why the jury form reflects accomplice liability as a basis for his guilt in this case. And the one other thing I want to get to before I run out of time is let's be real careful about our language, too, because I heard the state argue repeatedly in terms of active role in the case and whether or not Ms. Monitor played a, quote, active role. Remember, that's not the standard. The standard is a knowing role in the commission of the crime, and that specifically that her participation in the overt act that constitutes the offense is not required. So, in other words, she's not an accomplice if and only if she's the one that injected the drugs. That's what a principal is. An accomplice is somebody who, by definition, plays a knowing role in the commission of the crime in total, not simply that overt act. So we need to be careful when we are considering what exactly her role was, what she did, what she knew, and the fact, again, that I've just summarized, that she knew before, during, and after, and participated in every step of this crime before, during, and after, is sufficient to establish her accomplice liability.
Let's assume for the moment that she was convicted of aiding and abetting him, and we're on appeal. And let's assume that you're appellate counsel for the state trying to uphold her conviction. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would you point to that she did that would support her conviction for aiding and abetting third-degree murder?
I would point you to the fact that she knew before the administration of the drugs happened that that's what was going to happen. She knew that this speedball was going to be prepared and that they were all going to partake in injecting it. She participated in that discussion, and she participated in the execution of actually doing it. She didn't make any efforts to dissuade Mr. Lynch from administering these drugs, and she actively assisted with the cover-up after it happened. So it's, again, it's all of that knowledge in the before, during, and after, her participation in every single step of conceiving of what ultimately was this crime, the execution of the crime, and the cover-up of the crime.
But is there any actus reus of hers related to the administration of the speedball?
Well, remember, according, the only evidence we have is her own testimony, and she did not testify that she injected the drug. She testified that Mr. Lynch injected the drug. But again, that's the overt act that ultimately caused the death. She does not need to do that to be liable as an accomplice. And in fact, that by its very nature, the fact that she is pointing the finger exclusively at Mr. Lynch and entirely absolving herself of the responsibility for that tends to corroborate. That's what an accomplice is, that's what they say, and that's who she is in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Gaddis. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. And the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.